Thundergrunt.
Bob.
I'm going to see you. Awkward Who's pause.
That awkward pause is trademark now.
Hey. Who's going to say who first?
Welcome to Writer's Blockbusters. We're the show that treats the final edit of a movie like the script. And if Reddit has a problem with that, they can continue to have a problem with that.
Yeah, that's odd.
Anyway, today we're going to talk about the Academy Award Best Picture, Best Director, Best screenplay. It kind of swept, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it sort of swept. It, like, soft swept the Academy
soft
Award.
Swept.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Parasite.
Yes.
And because there's nothing more than three white guys talking about Parasite that needs to be said on the internet, right?
We're off our game. We didn't introduce ourselves.
I'm going to get there. I was still getting there. Well, first, we're going to go around the table and introduce ourselves.
That's right.
Go ahead.
I am Jimmy George. I am a full-time script consultant and screenwriter.
I am Jamie Nash. I am a screenwriter, and my book, Nomad, is now on audio at Audible. Go get it.
What's your Twitter handle?
Oh, it's at Jamie_Nash.
Did you give yours?
I didn't.
Give it right now.
At Jimmy R. George.
Jimmy doesn't want any more followers.
Yeah, stop, like, fucking
stop following
me.
No. I'm Bob Rose at Thundergrunt Bob, but I want you to follow Jimmy because Jimmy's Twitter is like the only marketing we have.
Yeah.
That's right.
And I don't just mean that in like a sense of us as a show. I mean, like, literally, I don't know what to do to market anything anymore without Twitty's. Jimmy's Twitter following is the only thing we have.
You can call me Twitties. I like Twitties. It.
They're Jimmy's fans. The Twitties. The Twimmies.
Like,
the Twimmies.
In Twitter numbers, you're not that famous, but to us, we're all so low. It's like, you're the one we all look up to.
Okay.
You're what we have, Jimmy. Don't you understand that? Mm-hmm. It's not, you can't give up.
Those late nights tweeting about dumb shit.
Yep.
It's been worth it.
That's it, because you're all we got.
Okay.
He's the cool table.
Because we know Reddit.
On the cool table? That'll be a first.
Reddit doesn't work. Instagram doesn't work. Facebook is dead. You're it, man.
Yeah.
You're it. Anyway,
Parasite.
On topic.
Screenwriting.
Jamie, who wrote this shit?
Awkward pause. No. Bong Joon-ho.
Right.
There you go.
It's a pretty easy pronunciation.
It's an easy name.
Yeah.
It's phonetically spelled.
After all these episodes of awkward
it's weird that
pronunciation,
the
this is pretty normal.
Parasite is the easy one to pronounce.
Yeah.
Right?
Isn't that it's not Carrie Fukunaga.
Yeah, we've had so many.
He's directing the next Bond movie. He directed the next Bond movie.
Really?
Wow.
The name you fucked up the most.
I just say that one really fast.
Yeah. Carrie Fukunaga.
So
Parasite.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about how it plays with genre.
Well, I was gonna go over his filmography. Super.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's do that.
I first became aware of him with The Host, which I remember.
Yes.
I remember seeing everybody was talking about it. I don't know. That might have been one of those ones I got a bootleg for at the old horror convention. I can't remember.
It was a little bit of his kept secret in America for a while.
It was hard to find, and I remember I kind of sought it out and had to go through some shady black market deal to get my hands on it. and then that movie was almost like a Godzilla kind of thing that happens. I remember there's this great beach scene it opens up with. But then, like I was telling Bob, then it goes into some other movie. It's like this big weird epic where they're living underground and they have bows and arrows and all kinds of
Have you seen not seen it, Bob?
No, the reason I saw it was because when Cloverfield came out, a movie I do not like. When Cloverfield came out.
I actually like Cloverfield.
I know. I figured. I like the
too.
Sequel.
I do. I love the sequel.
But when that came out, everyone
that third one was awesome.
Paradox.
Yeah, look at the poster hanging up right behind me. for Cloverfield Paradox. Man, we got to get on topic. when Cloverfield came out, everyone kept saying the host was a big recommendation for some reason. I see the parallels, sort of.
The class system is
It's
about.
I just remember people being like,
"Has have nots is there."
I remember people being like, "Well, you should see the host if you want." You know, when
which is odd.
Very odd. Yeah, but that was the reason I originally watched it. So.
I know people that are big fans. They talk about, and I have never seen Memories of Murder.
I have not either.
I haven't either.
I've heard a lot of good things about that.
At least we're all equally ignorant.
Yeah.
Other movies that he has
A huge fan of Snowpiercer.
Snowpiercer.
Love Snowpiercer. Yes.
Yeah, and he wrote two between those, Tokyo and Mother, which I also haven't seen. I saw Snowpiercer.
And I haven't seen Okja. Is that how you pronounce it?
Okja's awesome. I love Okja.
Yeah. And that was made for Netflix. Yep. And then Parasite.
Okay.
So I was saying earlier that, you know, I teach screenwriting. My college students are big fans of, this is one of their favorite directors in general, if I'm to generalize, Edgar Wright and Bong Joon-ho.
It's very interesting. So then that makes me feel like they like the style.
Could be.
You know what's
could
funny, be. Too? Is
maybe the theme.
Jamie, you've brought it up on this show, mm-hmm. how when people say their favorite filmmakers, it mm-hmm. always tends to be writer-directors.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Or remember you also asked us that one time, name your...
it's always tricky to name a screenwriter that's not
a director.
Name your favorite screenwriter,
That's the hard question.
Your favorite screenwriter, But
hardly anybody
but
can.
But Edgar Wright and Bong Joon-ho are both writer-directors,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah.
Yeah, so that's very interesting.
Edgar Wright kind of surprises me. I feel like that was like... he was kind of the hot thing 20 years
ago.
Yeah,
it seems like it's been a little while since his cooler movies. Though they love Baby Driver, I have to say.
Yeah.
The students love the Baby Driver.
Students love Baby Driver. Well, sequel's greenlit. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we're not talking about Baby Driver. We might talk about Baby Driver one day. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe.
What is a similar midpoint twist to Parasite? No, it doesn't.
Parasite's music scenes are way worse. So, as we said, with the host especially, I think that's the best example. Jamie, I'm assuming that's what you're trying to bring up, Jamie.
Yeah.
Genre and tone, right?
Yeah.
That's something we want to talk about.
You know, the host was an example of a movie I was expecting just Godzilla horror movie, and then it became something else. It was kind of silly in some ways. It had some sense of humor to it.
Were you inspired by the marketing there too? Because
probably
the marketing for this movie actually made me think it was something so different.
Interesting. I thought it was going to be an experience that informed your experience.
I mean, obviously, once I got into the movie, I was like totally into it. But like, I thought it was going to be a supernatural horror film.
Yeah. Oh,
from the title and poster. And, you know, I didn't see a trailer before I watched it, so it was just the title and poster. I was like, it looked to me like a horror movie of some sort.
It's really just a Korean rehash of The Boy. No, it's in some ways.
God, I saw The Boy 2. So.
The Boy 2 you saw?
Part 2. Oh.
Brahms, The Boy 2.
Katie Holmes for the win.
She looks tired.
Yeah.
Aww.
Poor, yeah. She's had a long couple years.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So the tone of this, I went into this cold, this movie. I didn't know anything about it. A lot of people were saying great things about it. I kind of purposefully stayed away. I watched it. And it's funny. I was telling Bob about it. Something about the translation of it, the reading subtitles. I'm not sure we as non-Korean speaking people totally land the tone of what, you know what I mean? We're doing some interpretation of the tone.
Do you think
that's why? Because I'll let you keep going.
Yeah, yeah.
But
no worries.
Because the number one thing I have heard from people who love this movie is championing it for its like doing things with tone that we don't usually see.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I didn't feel that way at all. I didn't feel that whatsoever. I felt like it was very standard. Do you think that has a lot to do with why so many people are feeling that way? They're reading it.
You also aren't normal.
Yeah, that's for sure.
In a sense. You probably read more scripts than, I mean, even Jamie, right?
Yeah,
I read
40 pages a day every day.
Yeah, you're not
amateur scripts.
You've pretty much taken yourself out of being a normal human being when it comes to this subject. So,
yeah.
But, okay.
Yeah.
The way that you framed that, that does make sense. Like, reading it sort of messes with your ability to read the tone.
And so when I went into it, I was like,
You're saying the actual act of reading it.
Well, I'm not sure the act. Oh. Maybe the translation part.
We're going to sound like some ignorant guys.
We sure are.
Oh, you got to read it?
You got to read it?
I came to watch a movie.
No, it's more the fact that you might interpret their acting differently from the words. You know, because you're not processing
you
both.
You put
at
your
the same
own
time.
Impetus on a lot
now
of
I'm
stuff.
At,
you're working.
Yeah. And
working
I'm asking a from a general response,
not
from our response. I'm asking from the general public's response saying.
Yeah, mine's not so much to say because I have to read it. It's more because it's in a different language. So I'm processing it differently than I would another film. So I am doing a different sense of feel for the tone.
Or yeah.
There's some inflection and things that are lost to me at times.
Yeah. Is that wordplay?
Or
I don't want to skip ahead, but is that why you think that some people, even us, interpreted the genre differences there?
Well,
because we don't know what the exact tone is supposed to be in the moment?
Yeah, I don't know. And I'm not even saying I had problem with it.
No.
Yeah, and I thought, because I actually, you know, I like the tone of this movie.
It's also, an execution thing. It's not really a writing thing, right?
It's strange because I'm almost wondering if I like, sometimes I'm watching it, like if I'm over liking it because it's not in English. It's a strange thing with me. Like
I love foreign movies.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Same.
I kind of am like, there are movies, like I always joke, like a movie like Underworld, if that was in German, it would probably be my favorite movie.
Yeah.
But it's not, so it's not. But anyway, so this movie, it starts out almost comedic. To me, it was comedic. Like it's dark comedy to me in the opening. Like when they're letting the fumigation kill the bugs,
kill
and
the
they're
bugs
like, "Leave the windows open,
yeah.
we can kill the bugs." Like to me, that's extreme dark humor. Maybe I could see in some contexts where it's not humor at all, where it's just dark. Like oh my god,
if it was treated
but
a little
people,
differently.
I feel like execution wise, even with the acting and the music, that's my number one.
Yes,
everything from like the fumigation, their house, all the way through like the I'll call it the heist section.
Yes, yeah.
The music and stuff to me reads, as far as my American sensibilities, as it's supposed to be fun and light.
Fun and light.
And we're watching this underclass family get a grift, and it's fun. It's playful, right?
The thing that it reminded me of was the show Shameless. It reminded me a lot of the show Shameless, because that show is about people that are down on their luck, can't afford the bills, their house is leaking,
taking advantage of the
dumb upper class. That's kind of the idiots. They're the smart ones because they have to live this poor existence.
For anyone listening, mind you, we're talking about our feelings as we watched it.
Yes.
Like we get it now, but we're saying like the tone will shift as you're watching it for the first time.
Yeah, coming into a cold.
Coming into a cold, yeah.
You know,
yeah. I just want to make sure I want to make sure they don't think we're like still now, we're like, this movie was
about. No.
I'm not saying that, yeah.
So yeah.
We're trying to dissect.
Yeah.
To me, it comes in with a Shameless tone, but in a weird sort of way, I don't know that it shifts out of that too much. It constantly, because even when it gets a little darker, it still kind of has a humor to it. It's just a darker humor. And Shameless might be a little more silly than this.
It's also a TV show.
It is a TV show. The
themes. And you have tons of time to mess with that.
The themes and the darkness of this do have an undercurrent of reality. And that's what makes it so cool, is because you can get your sadness and your depression and stuff with your kind of smiling sometimes, or I don't know. There's a dark laugh to it.
Right.
It's not like you're.
It's definitely a dark comedy.
Yeah.
That's intentional.
That's totally intentional. Like, yeah.
So I'm
like Coen Brothers-esque. Dark comedy.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, there's actors chewing scenery. It's very Coen Brothers. Yeah.
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 I have a couple questions based on some of the stuff that you usually use to like define tone. So for me, Jamie, you mentioned Dust Till Dawn as an example.
Especially for the twist in the middle.
Yeah.
That's kind of the premier example of tonal shift. Right.
Right? But yeah. I don't feel that drastic shift that describing. Because to me, I think the dread is there. Like, I feel personally, And maybe that's just my own personal station in life being lower. I wouldn't even call myself middle class at my current state. Like, I don't have a car. Like, I'm financially struggling. So I related to the financial struggle of these people. Yeah. So like, when the fumigation stuff happened, and it was funny and I laughed, but I also felt dread for them. Like, they could get sick. Like, I thought, oh, maybe, like, maybe they're going to be, like, one of them is going to have, like, toxic poisoning and be, like, slowly dying the rest of the movie.
The execution of that scene seemed like
comedic.
It was comedic, though?
I thought it was comedic, but I felt dread for them.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the second that they go into that, he goes into the house, and from that point forward, and that's only 13 minutes in, mm-hmm. I felt dread.
Yeah.
Like, I felt like, if this goes bad, like, it could be really bad for them. And then the deeper they got into it, the more dread I felt for the potential, you know, stakes for what happens if they're found out.
Why do you think you felt the dread? Because I think that's a key thing, because really it's low stakes in some ways.
Right.
Like, if they get caught, they probably get fired and they're back to where
they get asked to leave.
So I think the trick that how it disarms you from feeling like it's not horror is because no one is vocalizing the fear of survival stakes. Mm-hmm. So the lack of vocalizing any stakes for a single moment of the first half, no one is vocalizing any fear of what's going to happen if things go wrong. And I think that lack of vocalizing anything, like, there's zero debate about whether they're going to get in trouble.
The family is extremely, I love this, the family is so matter of fact that they don't question the plan.
Right.
There's no question.
Oddly enough,
like, they know they're in such dire straits that they're like, okay, now what's next?
Right.
Now we do this.
Right.
There's no, like,
it's not
moral judgment at all.
Right.
Yeah,
So, like, okay, for instance, like, oddly enough, I'll compare the Groundhog Day. The lack of a deadline makes you feel urgent.
Because this could be
So for me, the lack of anybody vocalizing what could go wrong is so naive. And so in denial, and so and like, I want
to
talk about this
and
later.
You're saying
when we
that
go
adds
to the
their dread,
their dissociation from what they're doing and the dangers for me made me feel scared, and made me feel like once this goes bad, it's gonna go really bad.
Right.
And I feel like the reveal and how it goes forward, it's sort of like you've been watching a horror movie the whole time. You've been watching a really slow horror movie. And then now their choices, every choice they make is more immoral and worse. And, like, all the consequences that lead to, like, the killing and the death and all that are just a result of everything they've been doing the entire time. It's not like...
It keeps locking that tone in
more and more. Ratcheting up
with
that.
With everything kind of falls into place
with
them.
They keep making the wrong choice and doing something wrong again, doing something morally wrong is what I mean.
Well, I would say that doesn't start till the second half.
First
half
it just
is like
keeps going and going.
All the
and
good
going.
Shit starts falling into place, locking them into the plan that they have no clue how it's gonna.
But I mean,
end,
it's
right?
like it's yeah. way before the midpoint that the montage with the peach, and that is the most, like, one of the most fucked up things I've seen. Like a whole family rallying around trying to give this person anaphylactic shock is pretty fucking low. Like, and none of them are questioning it whatsoever.
I was gonna bring that up. The peach stuff, to me, is where I think the movie does change tone.
Right.
When I first watched it, I was like, all right, so we're here now. Because this is now, without hindsight, without understanding the themes of the movie.
Right.
Because at that point, I was like, okay, well, now it's kind of hard to sympathize with these characters.
Right. And they're doubling down.
They're doubling down on it.
It's a wrong way goal movie, and they're just like, they're like, no, we love this wrong way. We're gonna keep going.
And it's like, I love that because it challenges.
I love that too.
It challenges you to be like, how do I feel about these people at every step
of
the way?
I absolutely love that. It reminded me, It reminded me a lot of Joker, and like, I hate saying that, but no, because
don't
it's
bring
about.
It up. No,
well, no, because
kidding.
It's like they're really hammering home, and I didn't break them down. They're hammering home those rooting influencers.
You know, I was saying this could be a good rooting influencers one, because they're technically, in some movies, these would be bad people, right? They're screwing over somebody. They're making advances on the young girl. They're scamming therapy to a little kid. They're anaphylactic shock. They're getting people fired with the panties in the car. They're doing all these. They're hurting people.
Yeah.
But because of the theme of the class system thing, it's like you kind of go with it.
But they
right?
spent 10
yeah.
minutes showing us how
bad.
Hard,
yeah,
how
yeah.
bad they're, when we meet them, they're working an honest living. They're fucking folding pizza boxes for dirt. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and they're
doing the best. They're watching YouTube videos. They're trying, man. Like, there's they've got toxic fumes in their face watching
in a basement.
Yeah, in a basement.
Yeah.
Like, and
there's something about their family unit that they don't make them like Shameless where they all kind of hate each other. They actually support each other and kind of are a
team,
you know?
Absolutely. So,
yeah, they're very much like, they're on the same mindset too. There's not like a defector in the family.
No,
you know
not
what I
at
mean?
All.
They're all just like, we know the goal and we're in this together.
And we can get, we'll get to the, what is it saying and stuff in a little while.
Yeah,
but
we'll
like, it's, so for me anyway, I felt the dread. I felt the dread from the beginning. So like even though I was laughing, and I think it was played for comedy, and I think that was executed intentionally to disarm us so that holy shit, when things get serious, you feel it extra. It's got this like extra oomph. Like Coen Brothers, it's like when Coen Brothers stuff goes dark, somehow it feels darker than most movies. Like, you know, when things start getting really dark.
And the comedy aspects, I'm not sure that they're belly laugh aspects.
No, I don't
like,
think we're saying that.
We're not
it's more
that.
Like the toxic stuff comes in. You're like, oh, God, that's
God,
so horrible.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Oh,
don't you, and you know, say like, again, like, don't you think it's a little bit of our American sensibility of tone?
Yeah.
Creeping in there. Like, oh, is that because we always expect a movie kind of to set the tone up in the first
five minutes. We have very strict ways that we experience the story.
Yeah.
A traditional story. So,
yeah.
But the tone question for you.
Yeah.
So, Jamie, you have your tone scale. You want to explain the tone scale?
Yeah. Well, I always say that one way to do a tone scale, especially if you're working with collaborators and your tone's all over the place, but also if you're working by yourself, is to kind of figure out similar movies. And maybe even make a scale out of them. So the one example I always use is Batman, because it so ranges.
Right. Yeah.
You can have, you know, maybe Nolan and things like that are on one end of the scale. Adam West or Lego Batman is on the far end of the scale. And you just assign numbers like 1 to 10 to each one and figure out where yours is. So you can say, if my joke or my plot point were in this movie, would it fit? Or these characters or attitudes, would it fit the tone, the realism kind of aspect?
Yeah.
Or would people buy into
it? And the self-awareness is a big part of it, the self-awareness. Yep. And I feel like if you set a number, if you found your parallels to what you're trying to achieve with this movie, mm-hmm. and you put it like at a 7, I feel like anything that happens at minute 1 would land just the same, wouldn't feel like it's a different movie and didn't belong as what happens in the end. It's just, I feel like there's no tonal variation at all. I feel like everything fits. I don't feel like suddenly we're watching some movie where this would never happen in the first half.
No,
like,
no,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't buy this
I
in the first
half. I also think From Dusk Till Dawn, while it's an example of that, it's also more, it's not as much about tone as it is about, like, content.
Yeah.
The content of From Dusk Till Dawn switches. It's still like the tone of stakes and everything
are
still there.
The other reason Dusk Till Dawn, while it fits but it doesn't fit, is Dusk Till Dawn was advertised as a vampire movie. So it's more like you were sitting there, when's the vampire? When are the vampires showing up?
What a mistake that was.
Yeah, it would have been a shocker.
What a mistake that was to do that.
But I guess what I'm saying is, from an instructive standpoint, I don't think this is a movie you go to where you learn, like, this is how you take a movie that's a comedy and suddenly it's a horror movie.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
No.
But that's what I'm hearing a lot. I'm hearing the championing of this being some thing that, like, you can learn from, and you can make movies that have never been made before by following this example. And I'm just saying that this is like a pretty traditional dark comedy mm-hmm. that turns into like a horror, you know what I mean? Yeah. It just progresses naturally.
Yeah, it's kind of like when we talk about Fargo has some moments where you really laugh. I mean, you really laugh at them, but it also has some very violent moments. It has some very sad moments. It has all kinds. It has a range of things in Fargo. I think that's what this is.
I think so too.
You know what I found funny about the Oscars this year is that, or just in general, Bong Joon-ho has really been talking a lot about he considers Scorsese his, like, the one, you know, he bows to and everything. But what you guys just said, I'm like, yeah, it's weird because I feel like your movies are way more Coen Brothers. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, I've never heard him talk about that.
When you say that, Goodfellas is definitely a movie that has laughs and love, and we kind of
Goodfellas
like,
is fucking hilarious, and it's also
really
dark as hell. Yeah, yeah. So
and then
yeah,
I
you're
think
right.
Like Scorsese imitators, like Boogie Nights, kind of are very funny, very serious, mm-hmm. very sad. So I think we've
Quentin
seen
Tarantino.
Yeah.
He considers his movies comedies.
Yep.
So
Yeah.
So I felt like we should. The big takeaway for me watching this movie is all about the genre.
So it's not. I mean, basically, what we're just saying
it's
is
it's a mastery of it more than it. It's not a mistake. It's a mastery.
Or
of
some,
it.
Doing something completely different.
This navigates something that's hard to do, which is mix kind of a dark humor with seriousness, but it never shifts. It never takes a left turn, and it doesn't start one thing and go left.
The story world
it doesn't go
remains
from parody to
that's,
horror.
Yes.
Right.
It
which goes, I think is what some people have been
are
saying.
Yeah. A lot of people are saying.
They think that first part is parody? It's not.
No, I'm seeing
silly?
A lot of responses that above all things are championing the use of tone as sort of something that's never been done before. And
it's that it's done masterfully.
You're just not used to watching good movies, I guess. Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Yes, you watched a good movie.
Yeah.
That's how it's done.
You watch the guy who really knows what's up.
But genre and tone is really it's sort of the toughest thing to get right. And this is a great example of
I also think that the tone has to do with the theme, but we'll get to that later, right?
Yeah,
it kind of slides on that scale.
Interesting because you say genre and tone. What is the genre of this movie?
I think it's a horror movie.
Really?
I think it's a horror movie with comedy.
I would say thriller.
Thriller. Yeah.
Thriller
but
seems
I guess,
more.
Well,
you know, it's questionable.
It feels a lot like Get Out, and that was the argument.
Isn't thriller a category they made up for video stores?
Probably.
I think it was because they didn't know where to put certain movies. Yeah. I don't know. Horror seems rightish, but yeah.
I mean, it's.
I always look at video stores because I used to manage one for a decade.
The reason
I put this movie. Thriller section.
The reason I don't think of it
foreign movies, but thriller.
The reason I don't think of it so much as horror is the good guys are always in control, sort of thing. I don't know. It's like
I mean,
there's
I
a
would
bomb
say
under the
it's
table,
the,
but
it's,
it doesn't really unleash to the end.
Wouldn't you say it's the worst nightmare of the characters coming true? The poor characters. Yeah,
oh,
the main characters
and the rich characters.
Yeah,
it's their worst nightmares coming true, and lots of people die, and
there's
murder and mayhem.
You know what? I changed my answer. It would just be in the drama section
because American Beauty kind of is that.
Yeah.
Way, and
there's a dread in American Beauty too. The whole time,
everybody dies.
Good point.
In the
end, yeah.
Good point. Somebody gets their brains blown out.
The VHS would be
in the
drama section, Jimmy.
Me of American Beauty.
It's got
tonally
elements
and
of that.
Things like that too.
Yeah.
It would sit in the VHS, in the drama section of the VHS. That's what it would be.
I think
it's tricky to categorize.
It's really tricky.
It is.
Tricky. When he entered the house, it gave me the same exact feeling as when Chris entered the house in Get Out, which is a marginalized person, an outsider, is in this wolf's den of rich people who think that he is nothing, right? So it just gave me that. Yeah.
Also, Get Out is overtly
right
a horror movie.
Right.
Well,
right.
Here's the difference. I think this is the reason I think it's a little different for me. Is I think the heroes in this case are the ones with the secret. They're the wolves.
That's it.
Yeah.
The heroes are the wolves.
The heroes
are
the wolves.
That's the difference.
Whereas
when
he walks in and Get Out, the dread's there because we know they're
the wolves.
They're
in the driver's seat. They're in the driver's seat.
Anyway.
Yeah, I got you. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Because they're they're the protagonists.
Yeah.
The family.
Yeah.
Right. It's a hard one to pin down.
I love
man.
It. I love that.
No, that's what makes it kind of. That's
I
why it's
love
masterful.
That we don't know.
Hey, I can't call it.
Yeah, me neither.
And I think that's a perfect what you just said, Jamie, brings us to our next point, which is
the monster.
Monster
in the
house. What is the sin?
Yeah, you want to explain
Who's
monster
sinning?
in the
yeah,
house and
monster.
Does it apply here?
Yeah, and I'm not sure that it does, but I can see why.
I consider this Jamie's favorite film term, too, by the way.
What, Monster in the House?
Yeah, you say it's like your thing, man.
It's funny.
It's a subgenre,
Of the genres, so Blake Snyder, Save the Cat, he has a section.
Book three.
Yep. Well, this is book one. Book three, the best book.
The best one. Right.
I still have to find the page number. Monster in the House. Blake Snyder has these genres, and when he calls genres, it kind of confuses the term. I almost wish he used a different term, which I always say too. They're more like story patterns.
Patterns is a way easier way.
That's how I always teach my students. I say they're patterns so don't think of horror and stuff. So his are more these story patterns. Golden Fleece would be somebody going on a quest to win a prize. Fool Triumphant would be kind of some ridiculous character coming up against the establishment or something. And then there's Monster in the House, which is my favorite. And it honestly, I think it's the best defined one too. I don't know why. I love it. All clicks.
The title
into place.
Covers the entire
thing. And
so,
you've mentioned plenty of examples that are Monster in the House that aren't horror.
That
movies.
Aren't horror movies.
Yeah.
So, and that's what I love
so
about
it's
it too.
The pattern.
It's the pattern. Even though most horror movies fall into Monster in the House pattern, almost
like Jaws or Jurassic Park would be Monster in the
Jaws,
House.
Jaws, Jurassic Park, mm-hmm. The Conjuring, The Exorcist, mm-hmm. all these movies.
Anything where there's like a perimeter of sorts, even in the mind.
And they have patterns for the way that the story unfolds.
I think if you feel like, because I think this is going off topic just so slightly, but I think a big part of it, the house is a trap. So it's the loss of personal control. Like you have
it's
no
the,
control.
It's the
over.
Thing the character can't control.
You can't control it.
Right.
That's the loss. That's the house. So anyway, the monster now says three things: a monster, a house. What am I missing? I can't
the
remember.
Sin.
And the sin. it was funny. I was thinking there was one more before the sin, but the sin. So the sin is an interesting part. Usually, there's a sin that brings about the monster.
Can
in
give
some
us
ways.
A famous example. That you can think of.
Not closing the beaches in Jaws would be an example of a sin. I can think of that.
Like Crawl, mm-hmm. They didn't take Mother Nature, they didn't respect Mother Nature, and they decided to stay, even though they had extreme reasons to stay. She still stayed.
So like Jurassic Park, it's fooling with nature.
Absolutely, not respecting nature.
Or, sometimes it could even be as, I don't know
the
if this really translates.
Nature.
The power, yeah.
But like, back in the day, Friday the 13th, have sex, you die, is in some ways a smaller version of it.
Right, yes.
We talked about Nightmare on Elm Street, not respecting, I can't remember what it was exactly.
Yeah, but. and Get Out, we were debating whether it was Chris's refusal to act and defend himself.
Right. Or it's
that was
a
nuance.
That was a tough one.
Or
was,
the world,
or his, trust of these rich white affluent people.
The refusal to defend himself
I think
and
sin,
say.
As a word, too, we got to say sin doesn't mean that it's morally wrong. It
right.
just means they're
it's a mistake. Exactly.
Can be
yes.
that, too, right?
I think, and it also isn't always the protagonist. Sometimes it's the world.
Exactly.
Like Godzilla, nuclear war, or something like that could be the thing.
So what's the sin here?
And I think, by the way, I think one last thing about the sin.
I
think
this. I brought this on purpose.
The sin sets up tension because I think sometimes it says more like we know how movies work. So when we see the sin, we're like,
ooh,
they deserve it.
Yeah.
They're going to deserve it. And we're like, we're in dangerous territory because these people actually deserve it. So it ups the tension in this subconscious sort of way.
Yeah.
Because we all watch movies and we know that's the way it works. Sometimes innocent people die, but a lot of times it's because of the sin. What's the sin in this movie?
Jimmy's smiling.
Because I brought this up because I was like, I wonder if they're going to disagree, because I like when we can't agree.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure there's a monster in the house, but I'll play along.
Okay.
I think there is a monster in the house. I don't think this is a monster in
the
house.
The genre.
Bouncing off of what you're saying, because you just explained it perfect. The sin creates the tension, right? So what... And maybe this is just really doubling down on my experience compared to yours. Mm-hmm. Like I said, when they got into the house, I felt dread for him, right? And why did I feel dread? Because he's lying about who he is. And I think that's the sin of this movie basically,
why would we disagree with that?
pretending to be someone you're not.
I don't know why you think we would disagree with that.
And that brings about, and that constantly resurfaces. It resurfaces when they have the family dinners and they're debating the plan, or breaking out the plan, and then when they're sitting in the den and they finally reach their peak, their pinnacle, and they have the house to themselves. The dad is discussing like whether this is something that hurt the people that they had to step on.
So as somebody who doesn't necessarily think it's a monster house, but thinks the movie shifts to a monster in the house in the midpoint, I'm just to play devil's advocate, because I think you're right. When you put this on the notes, I started to think, and I was like, what's the sin? And knowing the theme, or what I think the theme is kind of going for,
you're gonna say exactly what I'm thinking.
I think that sin is punching down. That's my take. So
it's just sort of,
you can punch up in this world and you're fine, and we can laugh and smile and it's cool. But if you punch down, then you're going to get killed for it or something like that. That was kind of my
guess. I think it's sort of the same thing. Because like when it comes up again, and this is when it does become the monster in the house, when they're in the bunker, they have the opportunity to treat them as equals, and they're lying to themselves about them being not equal to them and better than them and higher than them. And so they're like, no, we're the family. We're like, this is our house.
Now.
This isn't your house.
Right, right.
You know, and what's that? That's lying to themselves. That's a disassociation about who they really are. And like, it's even lying to themselves.
So in that case, the sin would almost be, it's not just lying about who you are. It's losing yourself.
It's lack of self-awareness. It's both. Yeah.
I was also going to say,
I'm with you, Jamie.
Well,
Punching down
is good. And I also wanted to say, like, I don't want to get the theme right now.
Yeah, yeah.
But reason this is also a really masterful movie is because it's one of those movies where you can easily see the other movie taking place within it, which is if the movie shifted focus to the rich family, it's a monster in the house for them, and they don't know it.
On the other side
and
of it.
And their sin.
And we don't know their agenda.
And they have sins themselves.
Yep.
It's Hand that Rocks the Cradle, man.
Right. But we don't see those sins overtly because it's not showing their end of this story.
Yeah.
But they, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You could totally see their sin from their angle.
Absolutely.
The movie that we're not watching.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. It works both ways so well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that,
you're
and,
right.
And he keeps committing the sin over and over, like Ki-woo, even in the end, he's in denial. We'll get to that. I think he's in denial about his ability to reach a certain status, like, and not accepting that he is not of
There's
that
literally
status.
A moment where he's put down. Because
yeah.
Of the, yeah.
And he says, you know, that's that whole, am I worthy? Like, do I fit in here? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's that, you know, lack of self-awareness once again.
By the way, I said I didn't think it's a Monster in the House movie, I'm sitting here spinning through. I can't really figure out what kind of movie it is.
I was going to ask that. That was going to be my next
in
question.
In some ways, so heist movies are usually Golden Fleece movies.
What are con artist movies usually?
I feel
they're usually Golden Fleece.
Okay.
Yeah,
I feel like it's Golden Fleece.
Win the
it's
money.
A con artist subgenre for sure.
I think the tricky thing is because there's no deadline or goal or one trophy, I'm not sure that it still applies. I'm having trouble with
it. I think it applies till it doesn't. That's it.
Where my head was the sin brings on the horror and the threats.
Right.
And what brings on the horror and the threats is lying about who they are.
I could see another interpretation of this movie is you just look at the first half of the movie and literally the twist comes right about at halftime.
Yeah.
As being just kind of act one or something, and then the lock in and stuff is
so that's
too.
We don't have it on the list before we go into theme. Let's talk about that. The lock in,
I think that goes with Monster in the House too, doesn't it?
Well, again,
very, very on the surface.
It's, it's really weird because in some ways I could view the lock in just as the heist plan. Like, let's do okay, now we're committed, I'm hired, let's screw these people. That's one movie.
Yeah, because whatever goes wrong, they have to live with now.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
So if I was writing a log line to this movie, I wouldn't put the twist in. So therefore, I feel the lock-in would be in the heist. That's just me doing screenwriting semantics.
And you think sort of the goal changes.
I think the goal changes in the midpoint and becomes a different movie, Dust Till Dawn style.
Gotcha.
Because by the time that change comes, they've pretty much, they could just, we know as the audience, they could ride it out. They kind of reached the goal where
they achieved the goal.
Yeah, without that problem, it goes on.
The goal becomes maintaining the ruse.
Got it.
And so now something is thrown in where maintaining is now the goal, right?
I'll jump to this super quick. So the midpoint, one thing about midpoint.
They're related. They're the same.
Yeah. And the midpoints, one thing that like Blake Snyder, I know, used to say, a false victory. So a lot of times, like let's say you're structuring your movie. If you have, and another thing Blake always used to say was a lot of time midpoints are party scenes. There's some kind of party. They're like Iron Man coming out. Hey, we're having a party or something like that. Scream, I think, has a party scene at the midpoint. And this one, it's kind of a party scene.
Yeah,
they got the
it's
food
the
out.
Family
they're hanging
party.
Out.
They're celebrating.
And a lot of
times, they achieved their goal.
When you're structuring your movie, if you have your outline and you're trying to fill the spots, like where's the midpoint? A lot of times, if you think there's going to be some kind of victory somewhere, it's usually that midpoint. And then it twists, it turns, it's a false victory, and that's when something triggers, like we see here, the bad guys close in section. Of
okay.
It. So okay. That's usually what happens.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
I mean, that's perfectly describes what happens. So, yeah.
This is a great midpoint.
It's fantastic.
Example.
It really is.
So my question, and I think you could
feel it coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've swayed me toward thinking that the lock-in is the before the heist, like when they're trying to, you know, get all the family together. Because my mind was thinking, well, isn't the big problem comes once the bunker scene
we're
happens.
Saying it like it's a spoiler, but
but I think you're right.
It's a tricky movie too, and this is when you're writing your own movies, this I always have trouble with these kind of movies where there's no end in sight. Like the movie we're watching when they're heisting, what were you thinking the movie was going to be before the monster showed up? Did you have any thoughts in your head?
What's great about it is that's not even in your mind.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that.
There's a guy living in the fucking house.
Yeah.
So what I thought was going to happen was it was going to all come undone, which it does.
That's what I thought.
And I didn't know how. But okay, so like I think the reason it pulls it off, and I think this, it reminded me of Dr. Sleep in the perspective change.
Yeah.
And withholding certain perspectives and then bringing them out, and that's why it works. He did a brilliant thing thematically where he put us in the mindset of the Kims. So we are so wrapped up in our own lives that we completely are like oblivious to the struggles of the people beneath us, which is what that is. And like, it's like, oh my God, that couldn't be more thematic. And that's why it feels like this emotional punch. Like I wasn't even thinking about her or caring about what happened or why she might be here, why she might need to keep this job. Like, so you're diminishing her struggles, right? So you're just as bad as them. So you're like, oh shit. And then the second one is the lesser version of this would have hidden it, would not align us with the family's agendas. Like I've seen script versions of this where we don't know what the family's trying to do because the writer thinks that that's the clever way to tell this story. But we're like completely aligned with their like hidden agendas to the family.
Yeah.
But since
we
become
them,
right,
which is the way to make most movies.
Yeah.
Write most movies.
Right.
And
a
agenda,
lot of people
the agenda
think
being,
I gotta keep, but since
the agenda being stab them from as much money as possible.
Yes,
right?
Get in, con them.
Right. Yeah.
But the housekeeper, we don't need to know her agenda.
Yeah.
So then when she suddenly is revealed to have a secret agenda, it lands strong because we weren't even worried about
just
that.
Just like it landed on them.
Yeah, exactly.
We become them.
So it's like these two little techniques that like combined make us go like, oh, shit. Because I think most people like landed with like that big holy shit moment.
It seems obvious.
Also that they're not the first ones.
Yes. Oh, my God. This is just a cycle.
Like, I think that woke them up to like maybe we're not as clever as we thought we were.
It's a reality check of their status. Yeah.
It seems so obvious, but one of the key fundamental things about most stories, like 95% of stories, is we want to be in the skin of some character and experience things the way they do. It's surprising how new writers sometimes miss that fact. Like that is 90% of the movies. We want to feel sad when they feel sad. We want to feel horror when they feel horror. And the way to do that is to align us with them, rooting interest, all that stuff.
Right.
But then also have everything they experience be the way we experience it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You have to align with how they're emotionally responding to like what's happening, the rises and falls. And I'll read scripts all the time where it's emotionally ambiguous on purpose. Like the main character fails and then you don't see how they respond to that failure.
Right.
The writer doesn't want you to know how they're feeling. And that sort of leads to us disengaging and not caring about what
happens
next. If I don't care how the character is feeling, why am I going to care about what they're trying to do? So anyway, I appreciated the level of alignment with all their agendas. Mm-hmm. Every single one of those characters, like the family, we know what they're trying to do to like a detailed extent.
And even the individuals of it. I thought
the
buffet scene. That was a buffet, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I loved how the father like kind of took credit.
Yeah.
Because he himself is lying to the fact that he's like the patriarch of the family.
He's in denial.
In this own heist.
Yep.
He's like, no, you're not actually
completely
charged,
lack of self-awareness.
Your son was the one who did this. Yep. You're just hopping on board. You're not in charge. I love that. So they're all They're all lying to themselves.
That's a good. I didn't pick that up.
Yeah, because that buffet scene, I feel like is where you kind of even though they're doing bad things, you still have that sympathy because mm-hmm. you see them kind of have
their
moment. Like, oh, they really do love each other.
Yeah.
Right. Their love for
they're
each other endears you.
They're making immoral choices.
But their love, I mean, I would say something like that with any like serial killer movie or something like that where they have like a companion, you know, Bonnie and Clyde type stuff. They're doing wrong things, but they love each other, so we love them.
It's interesting. Even then, they weren't debating the stakes, vocalizing the stakes at all.
They're just in it together.
Which is really interesting.
They're so in it together.
There's not a single moment where somebody's saying, what happens if things go wrong? Mm-hmm. What happens if we fail?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is really interesting. But go back to theme. Let's go back to theme.
Well, I mean, that's next on the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the movie, I think most people's comprehension of this movie, their problem comes to theme, right?
It's just
all the arguments I see in theme be theme. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think it's a ton of themes.
I think it's pretty blunt.
I think so, too.
I think there's lots of themes.
There is totally
saying,
lots of themes.
Which we're not used to. Like, the American audiences are sort of used to one thing.
Yeah, we're
kind
of used to a bunch of lasers, and then somebody says something. We're like, yeah, that's the theme right there. Family's important, sure. And then a car jumps to two buildings.
Exactly.
I get it.
We
yeah.
got it.
I think what's interesting about this one and why I couldn't do my typical moral premise on it, so to speak, which is
William Martell's moral premise?
No. Yes, it isn't. It's Stanley Williams' moral premise.
Stanley Williams.
Yeah, he's another guy. So Stanley Williams' moral premise is just kind of like a Mad Lib way to express theme. It says, vice leads to bad result, virtue leads to good result. That's basically it. And you try to state your theme that way.
Okay.
I don't know what the virtue leads to good result necessarily in this. I can kind of evolve one from this, but I'm not sure that there's a character arc that anybody missed so much. I'm having
tough.
A hard time.
The theme isn't displayed through the characters.
That's it. That's what I wonder. Like through their arc, at least.
Through their actions, absolutely.
It's
like the
I'm
world
Jamie
needs
saying.
The arc or something.
Yes.
And, you know,
the audience gets the theme, whereas the characters don't absorb the theme.
Almost like a parable.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Something.
The characters aren't like in the end like, oh, and the point is everyone should be equal. They're not saying that. We should get that. We're gleaning that.
The audience is trying to learn a lesson.
The aerial view of it.
Yes, the aerial view. And that's... So I wrote some down I wanted to pitch to you guys because
do.
I don't
please
know.
Do.
Go ahead.
So like, you know, you ask what's the one of the ways that you go to character arcs and try to dissecting is you reverse engineer the stasis equals death, right? Mm-hmm. And I think there's like I think it's trying to say lots of things and I don't know if I'm right. I think the big one for me that I said in the sin is, and a lot of times the sin is where the arc is around and where the theme is around.
Mm-hmm.
Accept your place on the societal ladder. Be authentic to others and yourself. And that is like the positive. And being in denial about your class and your status leads to false hope and despair, which is like, you know, all the characters who suffer in this movie, it's because they're like, I can be just as rich and happy as the people on the top, you know?
I get what you're saying. I don't know if I agree. But go ahead.
Okay, yeah, keep going. The second one is make an honest living with the opportunities you're given, however shitty they may be. And I think it's hopeless because if you do that, you're stuck in the shit, right?
Yeah,
but I think it's saying your choices are, I think another argument on the screen that we're being shown the back and forth arguments is, okay, if you choose to take the jobs you're given and you start poor, the best you can hope for is folding pizza boxes, you know? But at least you're not stepping on other people while you fold those pizza boxes.
You're getting warmer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a sense in this, and I tried to not put my head around this, that they were happier in the beginning than they were in the end.
Absolutely.
But I don't want to necessarily say they were better in the beginning.
I don't like
not
that because that seems like not a good
seem
lesson.
Like the right
No. And then
that seems really bad lesson.
No, that's exactly it. It seems like, hey, if you're poor.
Poor people learn to love your situation.
Well,
yeah.
No, and I think
that's
saying
where it gets
the movie
really
is trying to debate this. right? It's having a conversation about this.
No, it's more complex than
your standard. The third thing is treat others with dignity and respect. And that, like, the last words of Mr. Park are that guy who's literally been worshiping him for like 20 years in the basement, praying to him, Morse coding, worshiping him. He stands up, he's bloody, he's dying, and the guy looks at him, Mr. Parks looks at him, and he says, "Do I know you?" And the guy says, "Respect."
Yeah,
that's the last word. So it's the right way. Be aware of the struggles of those around you, above and below, and that'll help people. Ignoring the struggles of those around you leads to like death and fucking destruction.
Yeah.
The other one, I don't know. There's something about planning. There's some statement in the movie about.
I mean, they literally
plans
they verbalize
is vocalized like 10 times in the movie. Like when the son is like headed out for the interview, he's like, "My son, the man with the plan." And then the midpoint after when he's debating after it goes
after
to
the
shit,
house is all-
he's like, "Plans." Plans, you know what
the
happens
flood,
when people
after
make
flood,
yeah,
right?
after the flood.
Yeah.
When, you know when yeah. people make plans. So I don't know what it's saying about plans. And then in the end, he's writing a letter to his father saying, "I'm making a plan." So I don't know what the movie's saying about plans, but it's trying to do something. Definitely.
I think it's saying. I mean,
what do you think, Bob?
Well, I mean, as far as the plan thing,
just in general.
Well, let me say on the plan thing. Going with the fact that it's a movie about class, right?
Right.
The despair of the father. Talking about plans, the fact that he doesn't want to have any.
Yeah, they never work.
They never work.
I think that coincides with the fact that the other side of the movie with the rich people, they don't need to have plans. They have money.
What do they need plans for?
They don't need any plans. So it's weird, like they don't need plans, and he's saying he doesn't want plans because that'll just give him false hope. Whereas they don't even need plans because money, they can afford. Not to have them.
To go with the flow.
Their plan is money.
Yeah.
And that's obvious. The statement about class is right there in what I just said.
Yeah.
That's like the whole point of the movie.
And that was kind of my thing,
right?
With it. It almost felt,
I like that.
In some ways nihilistic, this movie.
That's what, yeah, I wanted to get into that. What do you guys?
But it's definitely on the side of the poor.
It is.
You know what I mean? It's leaning, that there's a message there.
I don't know that it offers how to get out of
the
answer. I think it asks, but
because here's the way I feel about it. On one hand, it's not saying fight for money because then you'll be happy, because that's the ruin of all of them.
Yeah.
They all get fucked over because of the money.
Riches, yeah.
They seem happier in the beginning, but that's a shitty life. So
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. So I don't know that in this world there's really any hope. And it's like, it's basically saying in this world, don't have plans and don't pursue money. Don't be rich.
But what isn't the theme though? I'm not disagreeing.
Yeah.
But isn't the theme saying that the world is wrong?
Yes.
Yes.
That's what the theme is saying.
Yes.
In my opinion, it's like,
but
this is how the world actually works.
We're in a cycle of
this
trauma.
System does not work.
And right.
It needs to be fixed because here is the example.
Here is what happens.
Yeah. They can afford to be nice because they're rich. And these people have to do the things they're doing because they're poor.
So
something is wrong.
So the reason I say it's nihilistic is because it says the world doesn't work, but it doesn't offer the alternative hope. At any time,
but
it
I
just
think
says,
that's the
get
first,
rid of this.
Isn't that
system.
A first step in getting there, though?
I think it's a philosophical.
But what's on the screen is nihilistic, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I get that.
I don't think nihilism is bad. I think sometimes it sends a good message.
But
I think sometimes saying this world
I'm
that you guys live in.
I could defend it by saying I don't think it's nihilistic because while the events might seem nihilistic, asking the question and pointing out that it's harming people. Shows that there's care in that it needs to be fixed ultimately.
Absolutely.
In this movie it can't be fixed.
Yeah, you're talking about bigger
picture. I'm talking about
picture.
Bigger themes here.
Yeah.
But I think
philosophy.
Also
by the way,
kind of know his
whenever
movies.
Whenever I use the term nihilistic, people misinterpret it.
I know.
So I probably shouldn't use that term anyway. But basically what I'm saying is this
the
movie,
money Lebowski.
Yeah.
Right.
This movie says there's no answer within this world.
Yes.
That's what I think.
The existing
world. I think it's saying
yes.
Tear this world down. And answer.
Build one where this can't happen.
Yeah, build one where this can't happen.
Yeah.
But that requires a leap of of intellectual addition on top of the movie in some ways.
Now, well, let me ask you this. How does the end coda make you feel about that?
I was going to ask that. I'm not sure what I
felt
about that.
Because the sun becomes the upper 1%.
Okay, so yeah. So let's just go into the opening and closing images because
sure,
it's
yeah,
related
yeah.
to that. Like when it opens, there's the bright, sunny, hopeful window above him, you know,
yeah.
the hope of light, because light is used a lot in this movie. We're not going to talk about symbolism.
The
light
chime,
is hope.
And, yeah.
And he's literally stealing Wi-Fi from the people above him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now the people above him have shut it off. So he can no longer rely on the people above him.
Isn't that
when
the man starts pissing near the window too?
Yeah, and they don't have at that point the vigor, as they try to say, anything to him.
Right,
they're
right.
willing to be pissed on.
Yeah,
you know. And then in the end, but they're resolving to try to steal Wi-Fi from somebody else now. Like they don't go like, okay, I guess we're gonna have to figure out how to pay for Wi-Fi. They're like, where can we steal it from next?
Right,
oh,
right.
go above
down,
the toilet.
Yeah, yeah. the horrible
okay,
so, up-ground toilet.
So going to the closing imagery, and so I've got a quote from him, and I took a piece from the script, which
okay.
sort of just like
is the quote from the DGA award thing where he talked about it?
I don't know.
Okay,
but I saw the quote randomly, but it gives context to the closing image.
Yeah.
Okay. And remember in Midsommar we couldn't figure out what Ari Aster was trying to say, and then in the script he literally says what he's trying to say in the last lines
of
the script. So in the end he's like sitting in the dark, right, writing a letter to his dad, and he's saying like, I'm going to get a job. Like, I'm going to do this right. But then he looks at the camera and he's kind of like, you know, solemn and sad and defeated. And he doesn't look like a guy who's actually going to do that. And Bong Joon-ho, I think that's how you say his name. He said, maybe if the movie ended where they hug and it fades out, the audience will imagine, oh, it's impossible to buy that house, but feel good about it. But I made the camera go down to that half basement. It's quite cruel and sad, but I thought it was being real and honest with the audience because you know, and I know, that this kid is never going to buy that house. So that's like hopelessness.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And then the last line of the script after that happens, it says, over black, music plays, bright but with an undertone of hopelessness.
So how do you feel like a lot of people misinterpret the ending there?
I think...
They think it.
Maybe he wants people to be able to interpret it as maybe you think he's going to succeed. Maybe he's leaving it ambiguous.
I think I've seen a lot of people say that they're interpreting that it did in fact happen. That's not him reminiscing of what could.
Yeah,
it happened.
To me, it did make me question. Like, now it's like, oh wait, he can rise up and own that.
No. Yeah. I always took it as him. That was in his mind.
Wishful fulfillment.
I agree.
A fantasy.
You know why too? And I think this is an execution thing.
Yeah.
Is because the last shot is a wide shot.
Mm-hmm.
It's not intimate whatsoever.
Right.
So it doesn't feel like something he personally experienced.
Right.
It's something
we're
he's
seeing
imagining.
It from afar.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You mean like the hug?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's from a distance.
It's from a distance.
Yeah.
Your explanation makes sense to me because
yeah.
It validates what I'm trying to wrap my head
That's
around.
That's why I mean,
which is saying, like, in this world, this can't happen. Change the world, kind of thing.
Yeah,
That's
why I was trying to say, like, the fact
I agree
that
with you.
It's showing you, like,
we're
maybe
saying
a better
the same
world.
Thing.
No, we are. We're agreeing.
Yeah, I'm just saying it more in, and again, it's something that is kind of get misinterpreted because I use the word nihilism, but I'm more just saying that in that world, there is no right choice they could have made.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
In the end, he learns the lesson.
And that's unusual for movies.
Yes.
Movies almost always is like, they should have learned the lesson, and then they would have.
Right.
But there is no
it's
lesson
It's a tragedy
to learn
with no clear,
I mean,
positive
there's less impactful lessons. There's like, they could have done this. They could have just killed the people that live downstairs.
Well, or they could
and
have just
everything would have been
never
fine
conned
upstairs.
The family lived with the way they were.
I think the message though is at some point that would eat them and kill them.
Absolutely.
Them.
Yeah.
Or
yes, the moral corruption would get the best of it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
yeah.
kind of a parable, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's like this
is
a story of why things don't work. The man and the
yeah.
family who
it functions
came to the
like
house,
that, I would
the
say,
servants
right?
who came to the house or something.
It feels
know?
Like you could almost see a fantasy version of this with a king and
oh, yeah,
a peasant
sure.
and
definitely.
Everything. It's
definitely.
Perfectly, it's all there.
So, I mean, he gave us the answers.
Yeah,
the director.
That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it is.
What I was trying to say. though, is like, I don't think people understand that that is not happening.
I agree. And that's yeah. I brought up the Ari Aster thing because the ending sort of left people in Midsommar with the same sort of, they're choosing their own ending to something that's
that
not intended.
Or, yeah,
I was a little confused walking out. Like, I was like, did it happen? Didn't it happen? Was it a dream sequence? Was it? I wasn't really sure.
I agree.
And I was like, there's no way he could. In no way he ended it on this happened. Like the son made it rich. It would just be, that would almost be like what Hollywood will do to it.
But
you know,
the Hollywood
like,
treatment
and the
of this.
Son made it.
It's
and
the
he's
son
married now and has
okay,
a family.
So the way I took it is that because of the scene with the planning thing, the father is already to the point where he is aged in this life of poverty where he has given up. The son, while having gone through this trauma, still has some sort of hope and desire to plan. So the fact that he can still imagine these things that we know, sadly, in this horrible world will never happen.
Right. Is part it of false
the
hope?
It's false hope.
And therefore, he didn't learn anything.
He has a plan, but it's not going to. The father is old enough to have learned that even with a plan where he is in this world, he cannot win.
Yeah, I don't know what the actual lesson is, but
I feel like he learns it.
The father learns it in the bunker.
Yeah.
He's apologizing to Mr. Park, who he just killed. He cries and apologizes. He buries the woman they killed, and he says, like, I gave her the best burial I could. You know, he's trying to make amends, and he's resolving that I'm on the bottom,
and
I'm just
going
to stay
here.
I will
always be there, yeah. Instead of trying to fight to go up.
And that goes with your nihilism, with your argument to in favor of that. Yeah.
I was just trying to say that the movie's commentary on the world makes it less nihilistic. That's all. I understand what
you're saying.
I understand what you're saying.
If we could just fix this shit.
It's a window into everything wrong with our world.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
It's a little what I say when I say tragedies. Like, let's say something happens and then everybody dies. And we can at least walk out and say, well, we know better than them, so we will live. You know
and
what
I
mean?
And I do think we get that. We feel like if things were better, if the like Bob, what you're saying, if the world would change, things like this wouldn't keep happening. This cycle of trauma and people stepping on each other.
This machine is broken.
The machine is broken. Yeah.
That family wouldn't be driven to be con men if they had a living wage.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. There it is. I mean, but that's not a theme. That's like a political statement almost. Yeah.
It is some ways. But I know exactly what you mean. And it's all semantics, whether it's theme or message. We don't walk out of that movie. It's how you walk out of that movie. Do you walk out of that movie feeling like, well, I guess we're just all, you know, fucked then. Nothing will change.
Right.
Or do you walk out? And maybe you do. Or do you walk out fired up to change things?
I walk out.
Do you walk out hopeful for the tomorrow?
It's nice when a master storyteller points something out so well that it kind of makes me positive because I'm like, well, here's a great example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like somebody really put the time in to show the exact problem.
Yeah.
Here's the result
of
the problem.
I feel optimistic from it.
Right. That's good.
That makes sense.
I guess there's less despair because it's like, Now that you have a chalkboard with the problem written out properly, you'd be like, see?
Open your eyes.
Yeah.
Open your eyes.
I left it like, I'm never going to get a car.
okay. Yeah, no. I mean, right. But it's nice to know that somebody has put it on paper. How's that? And then on screen.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, what we haven't talked about, I think is interesting, is the kids. We didn't say anything about the kids.
Oh, the little kids?
Yeah. Where do they add to this?
I think it's thematic.
You think it's all thematic?
The kid is in denial. Like, he's pretending to be a genius. The kid is pretending to be someone who he is.
I was going to say is that part of the theme is that, if you notice, the rich parents think their kids are gifted when they're not.
Yeah.
They view them as gifted and they're destined for something.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Whereas, like, the lower class people, the only thing they want is stability.
Yeah.
Whereas the upper class people, because they're rich, they can afford to look higher. You know what I mean? Our kids are obviously gifted, and they're going to rise higher than we ever were.
I don't know about – I think is it Day – I can't remember. I can't remember. The
that's
daughters.
Terrible that we can't
the
remember.
Daughters. It's Day something.
Because they're both Day something.
I'm sorry.
No, the boys' Day song.
The daughter. Day song. I think the daughter is there to give us a window into the shifting morality of Kim of Kim Woo, and or Ki Woo,
which is a good way to get into character arcs.
Yeah,
are there character arcs?
And yeah, Jamie, this is the big.
What
one.
Are the juicy ones?
I don't really. That's the part I'm not sure that. You know, that's the part that I'm not sure that there are. There is. They're bad. They're tragic.
It's a negative trajectory.
Character arc.
It's the tragic arc, right? Yeah. The downward arc. And that's what I wanted to ask you guys. Like, do you think, like, the stakes? It's weird. And this is why I said the Joker thing. It reminded me of Joker. Because, like, in Joker, basically, he's trying to make people laugh. And that's his stasis equals death. Trying to make people happy. And when Joker stops trying to make people happy, suddenly he starts succeeding. It's not a good success, but it's the character's success, right? So, like, when Ki Woo stops making an honest living, stops, like, doing the best with what he's been dealt, and starts lying and manipulating and pretending to be someone he's not, then he starts getting what he perceives to be a success. But that's like the downward
when
arc.
When he stops living an honest life, his life gets invariably better.
Right.
In his eyes, yeah.
But we know that that's not true. Yeah. We know he's like getting morally
corrupt.
Does
he learn that?
That's what I want to ask you guys. Yeah, do you think he learns it in the end?
No, I don't think he does.
Do you think when the movie ends, if he does try to get a job, that he's going to go right back into manipulating people and lying
to
people?
I don't think that's happening, though. I don't think that's going to happen.
Okay.
There's no hope of that happening.
So you think then he did change then? That's my question.
Does
he go back to the honest living?
Because, again, it's always the best way to look at character arc is how... If you put them back in the beginning,
and
with the
I
lessons
wanted
they
you
learned,
to say this,
would
yes.
they do the same thing?
Would they do the
same
thing?
Do it.
Well, how about this?
I think the father wouldn't.
The father learns.
The father learns. Yeah, but what he learns is nihilistic and sad and depressing.
Just we're stuck.
Yeah.
Well, do you think the son would do it again?
I think the son hasn't quite learned, and that's how that ending plays out.
Yeah,
right?
I think he has false hope.
I think there's still a
the
plan
planning
out
speech
there that works.
Versus the non-planning speech.
Right.
What we learned is that even the family is going to screw somebody over. Even the rich family, of course, because they're rich and they're screwing people over, and they're not really appreciating their servants.
Right.
They're screwing people over too. So at the end, they die because of it.
Yeah.
Ultimately, they die. I think
those immoral choices lead to death.
And I think he'll continue in this world that
But they have no arc. The rich people have no arc.
No.
Yeah.
No. Well, no. And the rich people don't really need to because they're antagonists.
Yeah, they don't.
They're another They're another debate of the themes.
Yeah.
You know, like the father is disgusted by the people below him.
That's like Parasite, the sidequel, where we would see their version. They would have their themes.
So going back to the punching down thing.
Yeah.
I could see. Here's the thing. I could see a version of this where when they found out the person was in the basement, they were more inclusive and worked together. Okay.
Right.
But they still would have probably been screwed in the end because, you know, they're being screwed.
At least they would have grown as characters,
that's why,
though.
Yeah, they would have grown as people.
Yeah. Instead, they treated them not as equals.
They treated them not as equals.
As below them.
Yes. So
and
there's also probably
lose.
That's where the tragic
side that's
of it.
The
there's
tragedy.
Also, there's also kind of like there's a theme in there about like the lower class, the different sections of lower class communities fighting with each other too.
Absolutely.
The two people can't afford to fight.
This movie is saying the people in this world cannot afford to help each
other at all.
That's where Jimmy's forced
the world where they have to dog eat dog. Right.
That's where Jimmy's thick themes come into play. I think they're the sub themes and stuff like that. This is a theme that iterates.
Yeah.
Spirals into different ways.
Yeah.
You know?
There's a lot of
just like the world.
Yeah. There's a lot of arguments being made here. But yeah, I don't know that it's, I think you're right. I think he's not gonna, I don't think he learns. I think he's got false hope. And I think if we kept seeing him try, he might crawl back into manipulating and lying about who he is. But I don't think the movie defines it.
Okay. Just from a very like cynical, you know, film boy sort of way. The reason I don't think the end's going to happen is because it doesn't make a lot of sense. Also, you know what I mean? Like, he logistically, just speaking on the surface, he knows his father is in the basement of a house.
Yeah.
It's weird to think he would spend 10 years just so the guy can walk upstairs. I'm like,
from an arc standpoint.
From a cynical point, I'd be like, dude, you could just heist him out of this fucking house.
Right.
Buy a cheaper house.
Wait till they go on a vacation.
And just go get him.
The new family's going to eventually leave that house. Just get him out of fucking basement. You know, I mean, that's.
No, what I'm asking is if he tries to make the money.
To make the money, yeah, it's not.
Is he going to go back into the more immoral choices and do the same things he was doing before? I think maybe.
Well, I think the best case is he becomes like the family who ultimately paid the price.
Right,
as well.
They do the same. He's going to look down on people because they didn't. Yes, yes.
So the guy who did arc, the lesson learned was it's all a waste of time,
the
which
father.
Is nihilistic.
Yeah, in the bunker.
In this world, again. Yeah. Again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The end. I'm just thinking about the end. Yeah. I'm like, he didn't even need to buy that house. He just needs to wait like a year, get any house, and then they just need to seek their dad out. No one's going to be looking for him.
No, the father's sneaking up to get food out of the refrigerator with the housekeeper anyway. So it's not
But he's given up because he knows there's no point.
I think he.
I know.
Thinks,
I'm
like,
trying to think like a cynical, like just people who don't examine theme. I'm just like, just from a standpoint of like logistically getting him out of the house, you only have to wait until the police give up the search. And then you could be waiting for them to go on vacation and be like, hey, dad, knock on the basement thing. And be like, they're not looking for anymore. Come home.
This is going to be my new Twitter hot take. Yeah. Like, stupid movie.
Yeah, stupid dumb movie.
They could have easily got him out of the basement.
Yeah, right.
No, but okay, so I think
I'm just saying there is an argument for that.
Yeah. Rose and Jack could have been on the floaty in the end.
Right.
Stupid.
But we're all kind of saying that.
Why did she run upstairs when she could have ran out the door? Right.
Are we all on the same page that he has a negative arc, that a tragic and a tragic trajectory, not a, he doesn't learn. Yeah.
It's not a big arc.
It's enough.
It's enough.
It's there. I think it's there. Yeah.
Jimmy, I think you put something.
Is he the main character, you think?
Absolutely.
You think he's
the one with the rock, man.
Yes.
The rock, the right. representation of wealth that he then uses to kill people or try to kill people.
Right.
you put something about voiceover on
there. So I
yeah,
think
what did
so
you want
so you know, I think we didn't do the structure but I think the two main deviations from American cinema that this makes is the structure is weird in a great way and it uses voiceover in very interesting, you know, that's the classic Robert McKee in adaptation scene. And God help you if you use voiceover. So I wanted to talk about the different techniques it uses. I want to get your take on like using these. So the first one it does, I thought it was really cool. It uses a flashback voiceover, which is we're seeing the plan be enacted to get the housekeeper out in real time. In the present day, but we're hearing voiceover from a conversation that took place before they started enacting this plan, when they were making the plan. Mission Impossible did this too. Fallout did this, where we're hearing Ethan talk about the plan they're going to do, and while we're actually seeing it happen, it was like really efficient. And then this movie makes you think that it's just voiceover, but then it cuts into a scene where people are talking and cuts back out and goes back in. And I thought that was really clever, and I loved that use of it. But
does that count as voiceover, or is that more of a cross-cutting editing thing?
It definitely is voiceover.
It's
voiceover.
I know what you're saying.
It's like a whole minute of her talking before it cuts to the pizza place.
The difference is it's not like a storyteller, like, let me tell you the story of my life.
Yeah, it's not an omniscient storyteller.
The
only reason I said it is because that could be something enacted with editing.
It's not a pre-lap. Like, it's not, I thought that was, it was clever because it made you think you were just hearing voiceover and then, we're in the middle of a conversation that took place yesterday.
See, there's a type of voiceover that talks to the audience.
And that's the next one.
Yeah, and that's a different type of voiceover.
This is talking to characters.
This is stealing audio and putting it in a different place.
But it's a very clever way,
it's
so fucking efficient.
Yeah, no, yeah,
right?
Totally.
Like, we're seeing other things
happen.
I almost don't
think Robert McGee would have a problem.
You don't think he would?
Not that guy.
Okay, that's why I wanted to bring him up and get your takes. The second one is when he awakens in the coma, and that is your standard cheat. Where he's talking to no one. He's talking to us. Where he's I woke up, this happened, and I couldn't stop laughing. And then I went to my sister's grave, and I couldn't stop laughing because it's so fucking funny.
Right, right.
And that one is your standard cheat. That's the one that Robert McKee says, God help you.
yeah.
And then the third use is when Mr. Kim is writing a letter. And we've seen that before, but once again, it's voiceover and it's completely different than the other uses of voiceover. Mm-hmm. So American cinema doesn't really do this where it mixes.
They usually have one type of voiceover.
One, right.
Yeah, one voiceover. Yeah.
And then the last one is the same thing reversed where Kiwu is writing a letter to his father.
Right, right.
And it seems like he's talking to us and then it's revealed it's the letter. The right. letter isn't, it's sort of like the pizza parlor plan. Like we're hearing voiceover for like half a page and then it's like, oh, it's a letter. Like, so I thought that was really instructive in how it like mixes and plays with voiceover in ways that like we don't usually see in movies. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. It's good pickup. I don't think I realized that. I just thought it was great editing. Really, yeah. That's great.
Do you use voiceover a lot in your scripts?
I like voiceover. Like, I don't really have the hard rule, never use voiceover.
Neither do I. I think it's dumb.
When it works as often as it doesn't.
I mean, there's so many great movies with voiceovers.
Oh, my God. Red's Shawshank. I love it.
As a rule, it's stupid. That doesn't...
Yeah. It's not my, I'm not a fan.
I'm a fan of it. I find it hard to do.
Yes, well. It doesn't feel ham-fisted.
So I don't do it often. And I also probably don't write those screenplays that have the kind of voice that it often works. Like horror scripts hardly ever have voiceover, you know.
Do you have, yeah.
I remember the time Freddy chased me around the block.
I committed the sin and the monster came in.
Voiceover seems to come into play when you have, you know, a heartwarming theme for America.
It's funny. I'm doing a comedy pilot right now. It's kind of Goldberg's-esque, and it has voiceover.
Okay.
Is that
fourth wall kind of style?
It's fourth wall kind of style.
So it
Arrested Development-ish.
It's... It's interesting. I find it hard. I don't like the way it looks on a page, to be honest with you. You know, when you mix the character in the voiceover.
It's because you can't read it overlapping with image.
It does look sloppy when it's like, the character's speaking in voiceover and then they're speaking in the scene.
You really have to be on your game to write it and give it a nice voice, you know?
Yeah, but I think this is a good teaching example of how to play with voiceover in a way that is like entertaining and nobody seems to mind. Yeah,
you're right. It's especially interesting for us as Americans watching a foreign language film with all these different types of voiceover.
Right.
So we're reading it, and like Jamie said earlier, we're experiencing it in all those different ways, too.
Yeah.
It is really, like, for a movie that is essentially like a one-location movie, it does feel like a kaleidoscope of different feels, and that's how masterful it is.
Yeah. We didn't go into visual contrast, but that's like a huge thing with this movie, the visual, just showing, you know,
how high they are versus how low they are.
Yeah, like
they have to walk up a hill to get to the house and then walk up more stairs
to get in the room. When they wake up from the flood and the wife is in her fancy bathroom in her vanity doing her makeup and it cuts to them like sitting in these beds, like surrounded by like, you know, hundreds of people who have been displaced from their, you know, from the trauma of the flood.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to her like in her fancy ass closet, like putting on
clothes to her heart's desire.
And then it cuts to the people.
She's party planning.
Yeah, exactly.
That is one of my favorite things is that his despair speech about planning is followed by her off the cuff planning for a fucking
absolutely
the dumbest party
the
ever.
The dumbest fucking shitty party.
No, hey, you want to come?
That's like one of my favorite parts of the whole movie.
It's just the use of contrast.
You know, she's like shopping in the wine store and shit. Like she's just carelessly doesn't give a fuck.
I love her as a character.
Yeah, she's fantastic. She's great. And she always is planning. She's constantly planning.
Like, that I think that's what's great too is like how much you love her versus if you really dig in how guilty she is of certain things. You know what I mean? Like, you really love that woman, and
she's
you don't
blind
want
to
believe
though.
She's evil in any way.
Well, she's so naive, too.
She's so naive.
I mean,
to
she
it.
Gets aroused by him saying he's going to sell her drugs. That's her turn on, man.
Yeah.
It's sinister, but not understanding that it's sinister.
Yeah.
Blind to it. Yeah.
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 Well, I mean, I think that's everything on the list.
Yeah, we talked about a lot more than I thought we were going to talk about. It was fun.
Yeah. Well,
it's a movie that is worthy of these kind of conversations.
Absolutely.
It's a good, there's a movie, I think Terry Rossi used to call them pie movies or something, because afterwards you go to the diner and have a slice
of pie. I love that. Yeah,
I think this movie is totally, so I appreciate doing this.
I watched this movie like 2 hours before I watched the Oscars.
Whoa.
So by the time that it was winning Best Picture, I had only just begun to digest what it like you know what I mean? Like I hadn't had time to think about it. I was like, okay, that was really well shot. All right. And I drove to an Oscar party. And then I was like, by the time I got the Oscar, I was like already completely thinking about it. And I was like, yeah, it did deserve it.
It's awesome.
It is.
I love
this great.
Movie.
It's great. Yeah. I'm glad we did it.
And what'd you guys learn?
I
don't plan.
Don't plan a podcast.
Yeah, don't plan a podcast. Well, I never really have.
Yeah,
I've been doing it for 9 years.
I think this movie has the arc of its own arc of awesome, where it's trying to change the world, but nobody's changing within it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's basically saying the world, you know, is the thing that needs to change, not these people or their decisions necessarily.
These people are a symptom.
The whole the whole game has to change. So. I can't say that we've hit a movie like that yet.
No.
I can't think of too many. I'm sure there's a ton of movies.
For the
sort
type
of
movies we usually tackle, they don't tend to have this type of thing.
They don't even try. They're not
aspiring. They're trying to have fun. They're trying to have fun.
And for a movie like that to win an Oscar and be doing good at the box office, I don't think I mentioned the box office.
We didn't talk about the box office.
We're off our game to start.
let's say this is because it's a Korean movie. When you think foreign movies, you usually don't think of box office, right?
Right.
I don't.
No,
I just assume that it didn't make anything in America.
So this one made $245 million worldwide.
That's good, though.
Awesome.
For a drama, that's insane.
And 52 domestic. But
for America, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
So I probably made some of that after the win, right?
I'm sure.
I mean, I said, it's still playing in theaters. When I typed in Parasite, it came up. I said, oh, I can go see it in the theater still?
Well, you know, because half of America was like, what? What's Parasite?
Right, yeah.
I got one last question for you guys before we end it, because I feel like we asked our last question, but who's the Parasite?
They all are. Capitalism.
I know. I just kept seeing that on Twitter, like really ignorant threads, like, I don't get it. Who's the Parasite supposed to be? Fucking kills me every time. Yeah, the reactions to this have been not great. Mm-hmm. From funny to, oh no. But it's a great movie.
Great movie.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I think that's everything, guys.
I think so.
All right.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
You've just listened to Writer's Blockbusters, a screenwriting podcast featuring two professionals and another guy. Available only on Thundergrunt.